Oh, what's the matter?
The generator's on the blink, said the mechanic helplessly.
What's the matter with it?
I don't know.
Well, find out and fix it.
The man was not a trained electrician. He had been chosen not for his knowledge, but for his uncritical capacity for pushing any buttons. The effort he needed to learn his task was such that his consciousness could be relied upon to have no room for anything else. He opened the rear panel of the machine and stared in bewilderment at the intricate coils. He could find nothing visibly out of order. He put on his rubber gloves, picked up a pair of pliers, tightened a few bolts at random, and scratched his head.
I don't know, he said.
His voice had a sound of helpless docility.
Who am I to know?
The three men were on their feet, crowding behind the machine to stare at its recalcitrant organs. They were acting merely by reflex. They knew that they did not know.
But you've got to fix it, yelled Ferris. It's got to work. We've got to have electricity. We must continue, cried Taggart. He was shaking. It's ridiculous. I won't have it. I won't be interrupted. I won't let him off.
He pointed in the direction of the mattress.
Do something, Ferris was crying to the mechanic. Don't just stand there. Do something. Fix it. I order you to fix it.
But I don't know what's wrong with it, said the man, blinking.
Then find out.
How am I to find out?
I order you to fix it. Do you hear me? Make it work, or I'll fire you and throw you in jail.
But I don't know what's wrong with it.
The man sighed, bewildered.
I don't know what to do.
It's the vibrator that's out of order, said a voice behind them. They whirled around.
Galt was struggling for breath, but he was speaking in the brusque, competent tone of an engineer.
Take it out and pry off the aluminum cover. You'll find a pair of contacts fused together. Force them apart. Take a small file and clean up the pitted surfaces. Then replace the cover. Plug it back into the machine, and your generator will work.
There was a long moment of total silence. The mechanic was staring at Galt. He was holding Galt's glance, and even he was able to recognize the nature of the sparkle in the dark green eyes. It was a sparkle of contemptuous mockery. He made a step back. In the incoherent dimness of his consciousness, in some wordless, shapeless, unintelligible manner, even he suddenly grasped the meaning of what was occurring in that cellar. He looked at Galt. He looked at the three men. He looked at the machine. He shuddered. He dropped his pliers and ran out of the room. Galt burst out laughing. The three men were backing slowly away from the machine. They were struggling not to allow themselves to understand what the mechanic had understood.
No,
cried Taggart suddenly, glancing at Galt and leaping forward.
No, I won't let him get away with it.
He fell down on his knees, groping frantically to find the aluminum cylinder of the vibrator.
I'll fix it. I'll work it myself. We've got to go on. We've got to break him.
Take it easy, Jim,
said Ferris uneasily, jerking him up to his feet.
Hadn't we better lay off for the night? Said Mouch pleadingly.
He was looking at the door through which the mechanic had escaped, his glance part envy, part terror.
No, cried Taggart. Jim, hasn't he had enough? Don't forget. We have to be careful. No, he hasn't had enough. He hasn't even screamed yet. Jim, cried Mouch suddenly, terrified by something in Taggart's face. We can't afford to kill him. You know it. I don't care. I want to break him. I want to hear him scream. I want...
And then it was Taggart who screamed. It was a long, sudden, piercing scream, as if at some sudden sight, though his eyes were staring at space and seemed blankly sightless. The sight he was confronting was within him. the protective walls of emotion, of evasion, of pretense, of semi-thinking and pseudo-words built up by him through all of his years, had crashed in the span of one moment. The moment when he knew that he wanted Galt to die, knowing fully that his own death would follow. He was suddenly seeing the motive that had directed all the actions of his life. It was not his incommunicable soul, or his love for others, or his social duty, or any of the fraudulent sounds by which he had maintained his self-esteem. It was the lust to destroy whatever was living, for the sake of whatever was not. It was the urge to defy reality by the destruction of every living value, for the sake of proving to himself that he could exist in defiance of reality and would never have to be bound by any solid, immutable facts. A moment ago he had been able to feel that he hated Galt above all men, that the hatred was proof of Galt's evil, which he need define no further, that he wanted Galt to be destroyed for the sake of his own survival. Now he knew that he had wanted Galt's destruction at the price of his own destruction to follow. He knew that he had never wanted to survive. He knew that it was Galt's greatness he had wanted to torture and destroy. He was seeing it as greatness by his own admission, greatness by the only standard that existed, whether anyone chose to admit it or not. The greatness of a man who was master of reality in a manner no other had equaled. In the moment when he, James Taggart, had found himself facing the ultimatum to accept reality or die, it was death his emotions had chosen. Death, rather than surrender to that realm of which Galt was so radiant a sun. In the person of Galt, he knew, he had sought the destruction of all existence. It was not by means of words that this knowledge confronted his consciousness. As all his knowledge had consisted of emotions, so now he was held by an emotion and a vision that he had no power to dispel. He was no longer able to summon the fog to conceal the sight of all those blind alleys he had struggled never to be forced to see. Now, at the end of every alley, he was seeing his hatred of existence. He was seeing the face of Cheryl Taggart with her joyous eagerness to live, and that it was this particular eagerness he had always wanted to defeat. He was seeing his face as the face of a killer whom all men should rightfully loathe, who destroyed values for being values, who killed in order not to discover his own irredeemable evil. "No," he moaned, staring at that vision, shaking his head to escape it. "No. No." "Yes," said Galt. He saw Galt's eyes looking straight at his, as if Galt were seeing the things he was seeing. "I told you that on the radio, didn't I?" said Galt. This was the stamp James Taggart had dreaded, from which there was no escape. The stamp and proof of objectivity. "Oh," he said feebly once more, but it was no longer the voice of a living consciousness. He stood for a moment, staring blindly at space, then his legs gave way, folding limply, and he sat on the floor, still staring, unaware of his actions or surroundings. "Jim?" called Mouch. There was no answer. Mouch and Ferris did not ask themselves or wonder what it was that had happened to Taggart. They knew that they must never attempt to discover it, under peril of sharing his fate. They knew who it was that had been broken tonight. They knew that this was the end of James Taggart, whether his physical body survived or not.
Let's get Jim out of here," said Ferris shakily. "Let's get him to a doctor, or somewhere."
They pulled Taggart to his feet. He did not resist. He obeyed lethargically, and he moved his feet when pushed. It was he who had reached the state to which he had wanted Galt to be reduced. Holding his arms at both sides, his two friends led him out of the room. He saved them from the necessity of admitting to themselves that they wanted to escape Galt's eyes. Galt was watching them. His glance was too austerely perceptive. "We'll be back," snapped Ferris to the chief of the guards. "Stay here and don't let anyone in. Understand? No one." They pushed Taggart into their car, parked by the trees at the entrance. "We'll be back," said Ferris, to no one in particular, to the trees and the darkness of the sky. For the moment, their only certainty was that they had to escape from that cellar, the cellar where the living generator was left tied by the side of the dead one. Chapter 10. In the Name of the Best Within Us. Dagny walked straight toward the guard who stood at the door of Project F. Her steps sounded purposeful, even and open, ringing in the silence of the path among the trees. She raised her head to a ray of moonlight to let him recognize her face.
"Let me in," she said.
"No admittance," he answered in the voice of a robot. "By order of Dr. Ferris."
"I am here by order of Mr. Thompson."
"Huh? I don't know about that."
"I do."
"I mean, Dr. Ferris hasn't told me, ma'am."
"I am telling you."
"But I'm not supposed to take any orders from anyone excepting Dr. Ferris."
"Do you wish to disobey Mr. Thompson?"
"Oh, no, ma'am. But if Dr. Ferris said to let nobody in, that means nobody," he added uncertainly and pleadingly. "Doesn't it?"
"Do you know that I am Dagny Taggart, and that you've seen my pictures in the papers with Mr. Thompson and all the top leaders of the country?"
"Yes, ma'am."
"Then decide whether you wish to disobey their orders."
"Oh, no, ma'am. I don't."
"Then let me in."
"But I can't disobey Dr. Ferris either."
"Then choose."
"But I can't choose, ma'am. Who am I to choose?"
"You'll have to."
"Look," he said hastily, pulling a key from his pocket and turning to the door.
"I'll ask the chief. No, she said.
Some quality in the tone of her voice made him whirl back to her. She was holding a gun pointed levelly at his heart.
"Listen carefully," she said. "Either you let me in, or I shoot you. You may try to shoot me first if you can. You have that choice, and no other. Now decide."
His mouth fell open, and the key dropped from his hand.
"Get out of my way," she said.
He shook his head frantically, pressing his back against the door. "Oh, Christ, ma'am," he gulped in the whine of a desperate plea. "I can't shoot at you, seeing as you come from Mr. Thompson, and I can't let you in against the word of Dr. Ferris. What am I to do? I'm only a little fellow. I'm only obeying orders. It's not up to me."
"It's your life," she said.
"If you let me ask the chief, he'll tell me.
I won't let you ask anyone."
"But how do I know that you really have an order from Mr. Thompson?"
"You don't. Maybe I haven't. Maybe I'm acting on my own, and you'll be punished for obeying me. Maybe I have, and you'll be thrown in jail for disobeying. Maybe Dr. Ferris and Mr. Thompson agree about this. Maybe they don't. And you have to defy one or the other. These are the things you have to decide. There is no one to ask, no one to call, no one to tell you. You will have to decide them yourself."
"But I can't decide. Why me?"
"Because it's your body that's barring my way."
"But I can't decide. I'm not supposed to decide."
"I'll count to three," she said. "Then I'll shoot."
Wait. I haven't said yes or no," he cried, cringing tighter against the door, as if immobility of mind and body were his best protection.
"One," she counted.
She could see his eyes staring at her in terror.
"Two."
She could see that the gun held less terror for him than the alternative she offered.
"Three."
Calmly and impersonally, she, who would have hesitated to fire at an animal, pulled the trigger and fired straight at the heart of a man who had wanted to exist without the responsibility of consciousness. Her gun was equipped with a silencer. There was no sound to attract anyone's attention, only the thud of a body falling at her feet. She picked up the key from the ground, then waited for a few brief moments, as had been agreed upon. Francisco was first to join her, coming from behind a corner of the building, then Hank Reardon, then Ragnar Danneskiold. There had been four guards posted at intervals among the trees around the building. They were now disposed of. One was dead. Three were left in the brush, bound and gagged. She handed the key to Francisco without a word. He unlocked the door and went in alone, leaving the door open to the width of an inch. The three others waited outside, by that opening. The hall was lighted by a single naked bulb stuck in the middle of the ceiling. A guard stood at the foot of the stairs leading to the second floor. "Who are you?" he cried at the sight of Francisco entering as if he owned the place. "Nobody's supposed to come in here tonight." "I did," said Francisco. "Why did Rusty let you in?"
"He must have had his reasons."
"He wasn't supposed to."
"Somebody has changed your suppositions."
Francisco's eyes were taking a lightning inventory of the place. A second guard stood on the landing at the turn of the stairs, looking down at them and listening. "What's your business?"
"Copper mining."
"Huh? I mean, who are you?"
"The name's too long to tell you. I'll tell it to your chief. Where is he?"
"I'm asking the questions."
But he backed a step away.
Don't you act like a big shot or I'll...
"Hey, Pete."
"He is,"
cried the second guard, paralyzed by Francisco's manner.
The first one was struggling to ignore it. His voice grew louder with the growth of his fear as he snapped at Francisco. "What are you after?"
"I said I'll tell it to your chief. Where is he?"
"I'm asking the questions."
"I'm not answering them."
"Oh, you're not, are you?" snarled Pete, who had but one recourse when in doubt. His hand jerked to the gun on his hip. Francisco's hand was too fast for the two men to see its motion, and his gun was too silent. What they saw and heard next was the gun flying out of Pete's hand, along with a splatter of blood from his shattered fingers and his muffled howl of pain. He collapsed, groaning. In the instant when the second guard grasped it, he saw that Francisco's gun was aimed at him.
"Don't shoot, mister," he cried.
"Come down here with your hands up,"
ordered Francisco, holding his gun aimed with one hand and waving a signal to the crack of the door with the other. By the time the guard descended the stairs, Reardon was there to disarm him and Danneskiold to tie his hands and feet. The sight of Dagny seemed to frighten him more than the rest. He could not understand it. The three men wore caps and windbreakers and, but for their manner, could be taken for a gang of highwaymen. The presence of a lady was inexplicable.
"Now," said Francisco, "where is your chief?"
The guard jerked his head in the direction of the stairs.
"Up there."
"How many guards are there in the building?"
9. "Where are they?"
"One's on the cellar stairs. The others are all up there."
"Where?"
"In the big laboratory. The one with the window."
"All of them?"
"Yes."
"What are these rooms?"
He pointed at the doors leading off the hall. "They're labs, too. They're locked for the night."
"Who's got the key?"
"Him." He jerked his head at Pete. Reardon and Danneskiold took the key from Pete's pocket and hurried soundlessly to check the rooms, while Francisco continued,
"Are there any other men in the building?"
"No."
"Isn't there a prisoner here?"
"Oh, yeah, I guess so. There must be, or they wouldn't have kept us all on duty."
"Is he still here?"
"That I don't know. They'd never tell us."
"Is Dr. Ferris here?"
"No. He left 10-15 minutes ago."
"Now, that laboratory upstairs,
does it open right on their stair landing?"
"Yes."
"How many doors are there?"
"3.
It's the one in the middle.
What are the other rooms?
There's the small laboratory on one side and Dr. Ferris's office on the other.
Are there connecting doors between them?
Yes. Francisco was turning to his companions when the guard said pleadingly, Mister, can I ask you a question?
Go ahead.
Who are you? He answered in the solemn tone of a drawing-room introduction.
Francisco Domingo Carlos Andrés Sebastián d'Anconia.
He left the guard gaping at him and turned to a brief whispered consultation with his companions. In a moment it was Reardon who went up the stairs, swiftly, soundlessly, and alone. Cages containing rats and guinea pigs were stacked against the walls of the laboratory. They had been put there by the guards who were playing poker on the long laboratory table in the center. Six of them were playing. Two were standing in opposite corners, watching the entrance door, guns in hand. It was Reardon's face that saved him from being shot on sight when he entered. His face was too well known to them and too unexpected. He saw eight heads staring at him with recognition and with inability to believe what they were recognizing. He stood at the door, his hands in the pockets of his trousers, with the casual, confident manner of a business executive. Who is in charge here? He asked in the politely abrupt voice of a man who does not waste time.
You're not,
stammered a lanky, surly individual at the card table.
I'm Hank Reardon. Are you the chief?
Yeah. But where in blazes do you come from?
From New York.
What are you doing here?
Then, I take it you have not been notified.
Should I have? I mean, about what?
The swift, touchy, resentful suspicion that his superiors had slighted his authority was obvious in the chief's voice. He was a tall, emaciated man, with jerky movements, a sallow face, and the restless, unfocused eyes of a drug addict.
About my business here.
You can't have any business here,
he snapped, torn between the fear of a bluff and the fear of having been left out of some important top-level decision.
Aren't you a traitor and a deserter and a—
I see that you're behind the times, my good man.
The seven others in the room were staring at Reardon with an awed, superstitious uncertainty. The two who held guns still held them aimed at him in the impassive manner of automatons. He did not seem to take notice of them.
What is it you say is your business here?
Snapped the chief.
I am here to take charge of the prisoner whom you are to deliver to me.
If you came from headquarters, you'd know that I'm not supposed to know anything about any prisoner, and that nobody is to touch him.
Except me.
The chief leaped to his feet, darted to a telephone, and seized the receiver. He had not raised it halfway to his ear when he dropped it abruptly with a gesture that sent a vibration of panic through the room. He had had time to hear that the telephone was dead and to know that the wires were cut. His look of accusation as he whirled to Reardon broke against the faintly contemptuous reproof of Reardon's voice.
That's no way to guard a building, if this is what you allowed to happen. Better let me have the prisoner before anything happens to him. If you don't want me to report you for negligence, as well as insubordination.
The chief dropped heavily back on his chair, slumped forward across the table, and looked up at Reardon with a glance that made his emaciated face resemble the animals that were beginning to stir in the cages.
Who is the prisoner? He asked.
My good man, said Reardon, if your immediate superiors did not see fit to tell you, I certainly will not.
They didn't see fit to tell me about your coming here, either,
yelled the chief, his voice confessing the helplessness of anger and broadcasting the vibrations of impotence to his men.
How do I know you're on the level? With the phone out of order, who's going to tell me? How am I to know what to do?
That's your problem, not mine.
I don't believe you.
His cry was too shrill to project conviction.
I don't believe that the government would send you on a mission when you're one of those vanishing traitors and friends of John Galt who—
But haven't you heard?
What?
John Galt has made a deal with the government, and has brought us all back.
Oh, thank God,
cried one of the guards, the youngest.
Shut your mouth. You're not to have any political opinions,
snapped the chief, and jerked back to Reardon.
Why hasn't it been announced on the radio?
Do you presume to hold opinions on when and how the government should choose to announce its policies? In the long moment of silence, they could hear the rustle of the animals clawing at the bars of their cages. I think I should remind you, said Reardon, that your job is not to question orders, but to obey them. That you are not to know or understand the policies of your superiors. That you are not to judge, to choose, or to doubt.
But I don't know whether I'm supposed to obey you.
If you refuse, you'll take the consequences. Crouching against the table, the chief moved his glance slowly, appraisingly, from Reardon's face to the two gunmen in the corners. The gunmen steadied their aim by an almost imperceptible movement. A nervous rustle went through the room. An animal squeaked shrilly in one of the cages. I think I should also tell you, said Reardon, his voice faintly harder, that I am not alone. My friends are waiting outside.
Where?
All around this room.
How many?
You'll find out, one way or the other.
Say, chief, moaned a shaky voice from among the guards. We don't want to tangle with those people. They're... Shut up, roared the chief, leaping to his feet and brandishing his gun in the direction of the speaker. You're not going to turn yellow on me, any of you bastards.
He was screaming to ward off the knowledge that they had. He was swaying on the edge of panic, fighting against the realization that something somehow had disarmed his men.
There's nothing to be scared of.
He was screaming it to himself, struggling to recapture the safety of his only sphere, the sphere of violence.
Nothing and nobody. I'll show you.
He whirled around, his hands shaking at the end of his sweeping arm, and fired at Reardon. Some of them saw Reardon sway, his right hand gripping his left shoulder. Others in the same instant saw the gun drop out of the chief's hand and hit the floor in time with his scream and with the spurt of blood from his wrist. Then all of them saw Francisco D'Anconia standing at the door on the left, his soundless gun still aimed at the chief. All of them were on their feet and had drawn their guns, but they lost that first moment, not daring to fire.
I wouldn't, if I were you, said Francisco. Jesus, gasped one of the guards, struggling for the memory of a name he could not recapture. That's the guy who blew up all the copper mines in the world.
It is, said Reardon. They had been backing involuntarily away from Francisco, and turned to see that Reardon still stood at the entrance door, with a pointed gun in his right hand and a dark stain spreading on his left shoulder.
Shoot, you bastards! Screamed the chief to the wavering men. What are you waiting for? Shoot them down!
He was leaning with one arm against the table, blood running out of the other.
I'll report any man who doesn't fight. I'll have him sentenced to death for it.
Drop your guns, said Reardon. The seven guards stood frozen for an instant, obeying neither.
Let me out of here, screamed the youngest, dashing for the door on the right.
He threw the door open and sprang back. Dagny Taggart stood on the threshold, gun in hand. The guards were drawing slowly to the center of the room, fighting an invisible battle in the fog of their minds, disarmed by a sense of unreality in the presence of the legendary figures they had never expected to see, feeling almost as if they were ordered to fire at ghosts. Drop your guns, said Reardon. You don't know why you're here.
We do.
You don't know who your prisoner is.
We do.
You don't know why your bosses want you to guard him. We know why we want to get him out. You don't know the purpose of your fight. We know the purpose of ours. If you die, you won't know what you're dying for. If we do,
We will.
Don't listen to him, snarled the chief.
Shoot. I order you to shoot.
One of the guards looked at the chief, dropped his gun, and raising his arms, backed away from the group toward Reardon.
God damn you,
yelled the chief, seized a gun with his left hand, and fired at the deserter. In time with the fall of the man's body, the window burst into a shower of glass, and from the limb of a tree, as from a catapult, the tall, slender figure of a man flew into the room, landed on its feet, and fired at the first guard in reach.
Who are you?
Screamed some terror-blinded voice.
Ragnar Danneskjold.
Three sounds answered him. A long, swelling moan of panic, the clatter of four guns dropped to the floor, and the bark of the fifth, fired by a guard at the forehead of the chief. By the time the four survivors of the garrison began to reassemble the pieces of their consciousness, their figures were stretched on the floor, bound and gagged. The fifth one was left standing, his hands tied behind his back.
Where is the prisoner?
Francisco asked him.
In the cellar, I guess.
Who has the key?
Dr. Ferris. Where are the stairs to the cellar?
Behind a door in Dr. Ferris' office.
Lead the way.
As they started, Francisco turned to Reardon.
Are you all right, Hank?
Sure.
Need to rest?
Hell no.
From the threshold of a door in Ferris' office, they looked down a steep flight of stone stairs and saw a guard on the landing below.
Come here with your hands up, ordered Francisco.
The guard saw the silhouette of a resolute stranger and the glint of a gun. It was enough. He obeyed immediately. He seemed relieved to escape from the damp stone crypt. He was left tied on the floor of the office, along with the guard who had led them. Then the four rescuers were free to fly down the stairs to the locked steel door at the bottom. They had acted and moved with the precision of a controlled discipline. Now it was as if their inner reins had broken. Danneskjold had the tools to smash the lock. Francisco was first to enter the cellar, and his arm barred Dagny's way for the fraction of a second, for the length of a look to make certain that the sight was bearable. Then he let her rush past him. Beyond the tangle of electric wires, he had seen Galt's lifted head and glance of greeting. She fell down on her knees by the side of the mattress. Galt looked up at her, as he had looked on their first morning in the valley. His smile was like the sound of a laughter that had never been touched by pain. His voice was soft and low.
We never had to take any of it seriously, did we?
Tears running down her face, but her smile declaring a full, confident, radiant certainty, she answered,
No, we never had to.
Reardon and Danneskjold were cutting his bonds. Francisco held a flask of brandy to Galt's lips. Galt drank and raised himself to lean on an elbow when his arms were free.
Give me a cigarette, he said.
Francisco produced a package of dollar-sign cigarettes. Galt's hand shook a little as he held a cigarette to the flame of a lighter, but Francisco's hand shook much more. Glancing at his eyes over the flame, Galt smiled and said in the tone of an answer to the questions Francisco was not asking,
Yes, it was pretty bad, but bearable.
And the kind of voltage they used leaves no damage.
I'll find them some day, whoever they were,
said Francisco. The tone of his voice, flat, dead, and barely audible, said the rest.
If you do, you'll find that there's nothing left of them to kill.
Galt glanced at the faces around him. He saw the intensity of the relief in their eyes and the violence of the anger in the grimness of their features. He knew in what manner they were now reliving his torture.
It's over, he said. Don't make it worse for yourself than it was for me.
Francisco turned his face away.
It's only that it was you, he whispered. You! If it were anyone but you!
But it had to be me, if they were to try their last. And they've tried. And
he moved his hand, sweeping the room and the meaning of those who had made it into the wastelands of the past.
And that's that.
Francisco nodded, his face still turned away.
The violent grip of his fingers clutching Galt's wrist for a moment was his answer. Galt lifted himself to a sitting posture, slowly regaining control of his muscles. He glanced up at Dagny's face as her arm shot forward to help him. He saw the struggle of her smile against the tension of her resisted tears. It was the struggle of her knowledge that nothing could matter beside the sight of his naked body, and that this body was living, against her knowledge of what it had endured. Holding her glance, he raised his hand and touched the collar of her white sweater with his fingertips, in acknowledgement and in reminder of the only things that were to matter from now on. The faint tremor of her lips, relaxing into a smile, told him that she understood. Daniskjold found Galt's shirt, slacks, and the rest of his clothing, which had been thrown on the floor in a corner of the room.
"Do you think you can walk, John?" he asked.
"Sure." While Francisco and Reardon were helping Galt to dress, Daniskjold proceeded calmly, systematically, with no visible emotion, to demolish the torture machine into splinters. Galt was not fully steady on his feet, but he could stand, leaning on Francisco's shoulder. The first few steps were hard, but by the time they reached the door, he was able to resume the motions of walking. His one arm encircled Francisco's shoulders for support. His other arm held Dagny's shoulders, both to gain support and to give it. They did not speak as they walked down the hill, with the darkness of the trees closing in about them for protection, cutting off the dead glow of the moon and the deader glow in the distance behind them, in the windows of the State Science Institute. Francisco's airplane was hidden in the brush, on the edge of a meadow beyond the next hill. There were no human habitations for miles around them. There were no eyes to notice or to question the sudden streaks of the airplane's headlights shooting across the desolation of dead weeds and the violent burst of the motor brought to life by Daniskjold, who took the wheel. With the sound of the door slamming shut behind them and the forward thrust of the wheels under their feet, Francisco smiled for the first time.
"This is my one and only chance to give you orders," he said, helping Galt to stretch out in a reclining chair. "Now lie still, relax, and take it easy."
"You too," he added, turning to Dagny and pointing at the seat by Galt's side. The wheels were running faster, as if gaining speed and purpose and lightness, ignoring the impotent obstacles of small jolts from the ruts of the ground. When the motion turned to a long, smooth streak, when they saw the dark shapes of the trees sweeping down and dropping past their windows, Galt leaned silently over and pressed his lips to Dagny's hand. He was leaving the outer world with the one value he had wanted to win from it. Francisco had produced a first aid kit and was removing Reardon's shirt to bandage his wound. Galt saw the thin red trickle running from Reardon's shoulder down his chest.
"Thank you, Hank," he said.
Reardon smiled.
"I will repeat what you said when I thanked you on our first meeting. If you understand that I acted for my own sake, you know that no gratitude is required."
"I will repeat," said Galt, "the answer you gave me. That is why I thank you."
Dagny noticed that they looked at each other as if their glance were the handshake of a bond too firm to require any statement. Reardon saw her watching them, and the faintest contraction of his eyes was like a smile of sanction, as if his glance were repeating to her the message he had sent her from the valley. They heard the sudden sound of Daniskjold's voice raised cheerfully in conversation with empty space, and they realized that he was speaking over the plane's radio.
"Yes, safe and sound, all of us."
"Yes, he's unhurt, just shaken a little and resting."
"No, no permanent injury."
"Yes, we're all here. Hank Reardon got a flesh wound, but..." He glanced over his shoulder.
"But he's grinning at me right now." "Losses? I think we lost our temper for a few minutes back there, but we're recovering."
"Don't try to beat me to Galt's Gulch. I'll land first, and I'll help Kay in the restaurant to fix your breakfast."
"Can any outsiders hear him?" asked Dagny.
"No," said Francisco. "It's a frequency they're not equipped to get."
"Whom is he talking to?" asked Galt.
"To about half the male population of the valley," said Francisco.
or as many as we had space for on every plane available. They are flying behind us right now. Did you think any of them would stay home and leave you in the hands of the looters? We were prepared to get you by open armed assault on that institute or on the Wayne Falkland if necessary. But we knew that in such case we would run the risk of their killing you when they saw that they were beaten. That's why we decided that the four of us would first try it alone. Had we failed, the others would have proceeded with an open attack. They were waiting, half a mile away. We had men posted among the trees on the hill, who saw us get out and relayed the word to the others. Ellis Wyatt was in charge. Incidentally, he's flying your plane. The reason we couldn't get to New Hampshire as fast as Dr. Ferris is that we had to get our planes from distant hidden landing places, while he had the advantage of open airports. Which, incidentally, he won't have much longer.
No, said Galt. Not much longer.
That was our only obstacle. The rest was easy. I'll tell you the whole story later. Anyway, the four of us were all that was necessary to beat their garrison.
One of these centuries, said Daniskjold, turning to them for a moment, the brutes, private or public, who believe that they can rule their betters by force, will learn the lesson of what happens when brute force encounters mind and force.
They've learned it, said Galt. Isn't that the particular lesson you have been teaching them for 12 years?
I?
Yes. But the semester is over. Tonight was the last act of violence that I'll ever have to perform. It was my reward for the 12 years. My men have now started to build their homes in the valley. My ship is hidden where no one will find her, until I'm able to sell her for a much more civilized use. She'll be converted into a transatlantic passenger liner. An excellent one, even if of modest size. As for me, I will start getting ready to give a different course of lessons. I think I'll have to brush up on the works of our teacher's first teacher.
Reardon chuckled. I'd like to be present at your first lecture on philosophy in a university classroom, he said. I'd like to see how your students will be able to keep their mind on the subject, and how you'll answer the sort of irrelevant questions I won't blame them for wanting to ask you.
I will tell them that they'll find the answers in the subject.
There were not many lights on the earth below. The countryside was an empty black sheet, with a few occasional flickers in the windows of some government structures, and the trembling glow of candles in the windows of thriftless homes. Most of the rural population had long since been reduced to the life of those ages when artificial light was an exorbitant luxury, and a sunset put an end to human activity. The towns were like scattered puddles, left behind by a receding tide, still holding some precious drops of electricity, but drying out in a desert of rations, quotas, controls, and power conservation rules. But when the place that had once been the source of the tide, New York City, rose in the distance before them, it was still extending its lights to the sky, still defying the primordial darkness, almost as if, in an ultimate effort, in a final appeal for help, it were now stretching its arms to the plane that was crossing its sky. Involuntarily they sat up, as if at respectful attention, at the deathbed of what had been greatness. Looking down they could see the last convulsions. The lights of the cars were darting through the streets, like animals trapped in a maze, frantically seeking an exit. The bridges were jammed with cars. The approaches to the bridges were veins of massed headlights, glittering bottlenecks stopping all motion, and the desperate screaming of sirens reached faintly to the height of the plain. The news of the continent's severed artery had now engulfed the city. Men were deserting their posts, trying in panic to abandon New York, seeking escape where all roads were cut off, and escape was no longer possible. The plane was above the peaks of the skyscrapers when suddenly, with the abruptness of a shudder, as if the ground had parted to engulf it, the city disappeared from the face of the earth. It took them a moment to realize that the panic had reached the power stations, and that the lights of New York had gone out. Dagny gasped. "Don't look down," Galt ordered sharply.
She raised her eyes to his face. His face had that look of austerity with which she had always seen him meet facts. She remembered the story Francisco had told her. He had quit the 20th century. He was living in a garret in a slum neighborhood. He stepped to the window and pointed at the skyscrapers of the city. He said that we had to extinguish the lights of the world, and when we would see the lights of New York go out, we would know that our job was done. She thought of it when she saw the three of them, John Galt, Francisco D'Anconia, Ragnar Danneskiold, look silently at one another for a moment. She glanced at Reardon. He was not looking down. He was looking ahead, as she had seen him look at an untouched countryside, with a glance appraising the possibilities of action. When she looked at the darkness ahead, another memory rose in her mind. The moment when, circling above the Afton airport, she had seen the silver body of a plane rise like a phoenix from the darkness of the earth. She knew that now, at this hour, their plane was carrying all that was left of New York City. She looked ahead. The earth would be as empty as the space where their propeller was cutting an unobstructed path, as empty and as free. She knew what Nat Taggart had felt at his start and why now, for the first time, she was following him in full loyalty, the confident sense of facing a void and of knowing that one has a continent to build. She felt the whole struggle of her past rising before her and dropping away, leaving her here on the height of this moment. She smiled, and the words in her mind, appraising and sealing the past, were the words of courage, pride, and dedication, which most men had never understood, the words of a businessman's language. Price, no object. She did not gasp, and she felt no tremor when, in the darkness below, she saw a small string of lighted dots struggling slowly westward through the void, with the long, bright dash of a headlight groping to protect the safety of its way. She felt nothing, even though it was a train, and she knew that it had no destination but the void. She turned to Galt. He was watching her face, as if he had been following her thoughts. She saw the reflection of her smile in his. "It's the end," she said. "It's the beginning," he answered. Then they lay still, leaning back in their chairs, silently looking at each other. Then their persons filled each other's awareness as the sum and meaning of the future. But the sum included the knowledge of all that had had to be earned before the person of another being could come to embody the value of one's existence. New York was far behind them when they heard Danneskiold answer a call from the radio. "Yes, he's awake. I don't think he'll sleep tonight." "Yes, I think he can." He turned to glance over his shoulder. "John, Dr. Axton would like to speak to you." "What? Is he on one of those planes behind us?" "Certainly." Galt leaped forward to seize the microphone. "Hello, Dr. Axton," he said. The quiet, low tone of his voice was the audible image of a smile transmitted through space. "Hello, John." The too conscious steadiness of Hugh Axton's voice confessed at what cost he had waited to learn whether he would ever pronounce these two words again. "I just wanted to hear your voice. Just to know that you're all right." Galt chuckled and, in the tone of a student proudly presenting a completed task of homework as proof of a lesson well learned, he answered, "Of course I am all right, Professor. I had to be. A is A." The locomotive of the eastbound Comet broke down in the middle of a desert in Arizona. It stopped abruptly, for no visible reason, like a man who had not permitted himself to know that he was bearing too much. Some overstrained connection snapped for good. When Eddie Willers called for the conductor, he waited a long time before the man came in, and he sensed the answer to his question by the look of resignation on the man's face. "The engineer is trying to find out what's wrong, Mr. Willers," he answered softly, in a tone implying that it was his duty to hope, but that he had held no hope for years. "He doesn't know?" "He's working on it," The conductor waited for a polite half-minute and turned to go, but stopped to volunteer an explanation, as if some dim, rational habit told him that any attempt to explain made any unadmitted terror easier to bear. "Those diesels of ours aren't fit to be sent out on the road, Mr. Willers. They weren't worth repairing long ago."
"I know," said Eddie Willers quietly. The conductor sensed that his explanation was worse than none. It led to questions that men did not ask these days. He shook his head and went out. Eddie Willers sat looking at the empty darkness beyond the window. This was the first eastbound Comet out of San Francisco in many days. She was the child of his tortured effort to re-establish transcontinental service. He could not tell what the past few days had cost him or what he had done to save the San Francisco terminal from the blind chaos of a civil war that men were fighting with no concept of their goals. There was no way to remember the deals he had made on the basis of the range of every shifting moment. He knew only that he had obtained immunity for the terminal from the leaders of three different warring factions, that he had found a man for the post of terminal manager who did not seem to have given up altogether, that he had started one more Taggart Comet on her eastward run with the best diesel engine and the best crew available, and that he had boarded her for his return journey to New York with no knowledge of how long his achievement would last. He had never had to work so hard. He had done his job as conscientiously well as he had always done any assignment, but it was as if he had worked in a vacuum, as if his energy had found no transmitters and had run into the sands of some such desert as the one beyond the window of the Comet. He shuddered. He felt a moment's kinship with the stalled engine of the train. After a while, he summoned the conductor once more. "How is it going?" he asked. The conductor shrugged and shook his head. "Send the fireman to a track phone. Have him tell the division headquarters to send us the best mechanic available."
"Yes, sir." There was nothing to see beyond the window. Turning off the light, Eddie Willers could distinguish a gray spread dotted by the black spots of cacti, with no start to it and no end. He wondered how men had ever ventured to cross it, and at what price, in the days when there were no trains. He jerked his head away and snapped on the light. It was only the fact that the Comet was in exile, he thought, that gave him this sense of pressing anxiety. She was stalled on an alien rail, on the borrowed track of the Atlantic Southern that ran through Arizona, the track they were using without payment. He had to get her out of here, he thought. He would not feel like this once they returned to their own rail. But the junction suddenly seemed an insurmountable distance away, on the shore of the Mississippi, at the Taggart Bridge. No, he thought, that was not all. He had to admit to himself what images were nagging him with a sense of uneasiness he could neither grasp nor dispel. They were too meaningless to define and too inexplicable to dismiss. One was the image of a way station they had passed without stopping more than 2 hours ago. He had noticed the empty platform and the brightly lighted windows of the small station building. The lights came from empty rooms. He had seen no single human figure, neither in the building nor on the tracks outside. The other image was of the next way station they had passed. Its platform was jammed with an agitated mob. Now they were far beyond the reach of the light or sound of any station. He had to get the Comet out of here, he thought. He wondered why he felt it with such urgency, and why it had seemed so crucially important to re-establish the Comet's run. A mere handful of passengers was rattling in her empty cars. Men had no place to go and no goals to reach. It was not for their sake that he had struggled. He could not say for whose. Two phrases stood as the answer in his mind, driving him with the vagueness of a prayer and the scalding force of an absolute. One was, "From ocean to ocean forever." The other was, "Don't let it go." The conductor returned an hour later with the fireman, whose face looked oddly grim.
"Mr. Willers," said the fireman slowly, "Division headquarters does not answer."
Eddie Willers sat up, his mind refusing to believe it, yet knowing suddenly that for some inexplicable reason, this was what he had expected. "It's impossible," he said, his voice low. The fireman was looking at him, not moving. The track phone must have been out of order.
"No, Mr. Willers, it was not out of order.
The line was alive, all right.
The division headquarters wasn't.
I mean, there was no one there to answer, or else no one who cared to." "But you know that that's impossible." The fireman shrugged. Men did not consider any disaster impossible these days. Eddie Willers leaped to his feet. "Go down the length of the train," he ordered the conductor. "Knock on all the doors, the occupied ones, that is, and see whether there's an electrical engineer aboard."
"Yes, sir."
Eddie knew that they felt as he felt it, that they would find no such man. Not among the lethargic, extinguished faces of the passengers they had seen. "Come on," he ordered, turning to the firemen. They climbed together aboard the locomotive. The gray-haired engineer was sitting in his chair, staring out at the cacti. The engine's headlight had stayed on, and it stretched out into the night, motionless and straight, reaching nothing but the dissolving blur of cross ties. "Let's try to find what's wrong," said Eddie, removing his coat, his voice half order, half plea. "Let's try some more."
"Yes, sir," said the engineer, without resentment or hope.
The engineer had exhausted his meager store of knowledge. He had checked every source of trouble he could think of. He went crawling over and under the machinery, unscrewing its parts and screwing them back again, taking out pieces and replacing them, dismembering the motors at random, like a child taking a clock apart, but without the child's conviction that knowledge is possible. The fireman kept leaning out of the cab's window, glancing at the black stillness and shivering, as if from the night air that was growing colder. "Don't worry," said Eddie Willers, assuming a tone of confidence. "We've got to do our best, but if we fail, they'll send us help sooner or later. They don't abandon trains in the middle of nowhere."
"They didn't used to," said the fireman.
Once in a while, the engineer raised his grease-smeared face to look at the grease-smeared face and shirt of Eddie Willers.
"What's the use, Mr. Willers?" he asked.
"We can't let it go," Eddie answered fiercely. He knew dimly that what he meant was more than the comet, and more than the railroad. Moving from the cab through the three motor units and back to the cab again, his hands bleeding, his shirt sticking to his back, Eddie Willers was struggling to remember everything he had ever known about engines, anything he had learned in college and earlier, anything he had picked up in those days when the station agents at Rockdale Station used to chase him off the rungs of their lumbering switch engines. The pieces connected to nothing. His brain seemed jammed and tight. He knew that motors were not his profession. He knew that he did not know, and that it was now a matter of life or death for him to discover the knowledge. He was looking at the cylinders, the blades, the wires, the control panels still winking with lights. He was struggling not to allow into his mind the thought that was pressing against its periphery. What were the chances, and how long would it take, according to the mathematical theory of probability, for primitive men, working by rule of thumb, to hit the right combination of parts and recreate the motor of this engine?
"What's the use, Mr. Willers?" moaned the engineer.
"We can't let it go," he cried. He did not know how many hours had passed when he heard the fireman shout suddenly, "Mr. Willers, look!" The fireman was leaning out the window, pointing into the darkness behind them. Eddie Willers looked. An odd little light was swinging jerkily far in the distance. It seemed to be advancing at an imperceptible rate. It did not look like any sort of light he could identify. After a while, it seemed to him that he distinguished some large black shapes advancing slowly. They were moving in a line parallel with the track. The spot of light hung low over the ground, swinging. He strained his ears, but heard nothing. Then he caught a feeble, muffled beat that sounded like the hoofs of horses. The two men beside him were watching the black shapes with a look of growing terror, as if some supernatural apparition were advancing upon them out of the desert night. In the moment when they chuckled suddenly, joyously, recognizing the shapes, it was Eddie's face that froze into a look of terror at the sight of a ghost more frightening than any they could have expected. It was a train of covered wagons. The swinging lantern jerked to a stop by the side of the engine.
"Hey, bud, can I give you a lift?" called the man who seemed to be the leader.
He was chuckling.
"Stuck, aren't you?"
The passengers of the Comet were peering out of the windows. Some were descending the steps and approaching. Women's faces peeked from the wagons, from among the piles of household goods. A baby wailed somewhere at the rear of the caravan.
"Are you crazy?" asked Eddie Willers.
"No, I mean it, brother. We got plenty of room. We'll give you folks a lift, for a price, if you want to get out of here."
He was a lanky, nervous man, with loose gestures and an insolent voice, who looked like a sideshow barker.
"This is the Taggart Comet," said Eddie Willers, choking.
"The Comet, eh? Looks more like a dead caterpillar to me. What's the matter, brother? You're not going anywhere. You can't get there anymore, even if you tried."
"What do you mean?"
"You don't think you're going to New York, do you?"
"We are going to New York."
Then you haven't heard?"
"What?"
"Say, when was the last time you spoke to any of your stations?"
"I don't know. Heard what?"
"That your Taggart Bridge is gone."
"Gone?
Blasted to bits. Sound ray explosion or something. Nobody knows exactly. Only there ain't any bridge anymore to cross the Mississippi. There ain't any New York anymore. Leastways not for folks like you and me to reach."
Eddie Willers did not know what happened next. He had fallen back against the side of the engineer's chair, staring at the open door of the motor unit. He did not know how long he stayed there, but when, at last, he turned his head, he saw that he was alone. The engineer and the fireman had left the cab. There was a scramble of voices outside, screams, sobs, shouted questions, and the sound of the sideshow barker's laughter. Eddie pulled himself to the window of the cab. The Comet's passengers and crew were crowding around the leader of the caravan and his semi-ragged companions. He was waving his loose arms in gestures of command. Some of the better-dressed ladies from the Comet, whose husbands had apparently been first to make a deal, were climbing aboard the covered wagons, sobbing and clutching their delicate makeup cases.
"Step right up, folks, step right up," the barker was yelling cheerfully. "We'll make room for everybody. A bit crowded, but moving. Better than being left here for coyote fodder. The day of the iron horse is past. All we got is plain old-fashioned horse. Slow, but sure."
Eddie Willers climbed halfway down the ladder on the side of the engine to see the crowd and to be heard. He waved one arm, hanging onto the rungs with the other.
"You're not going, are you?"
he cried to his passengers.
"You're not abandoning the Comet."
They drew a little away from him, as if they did not want to look at him or answer. They did not want to hear questions their minds were incapable of weighing. He saw the blind faces of panic.
"What's the matter with the grease monkey?" asked the barker, pointing at Eddie.
"Mr. Willers,"
said the conductor softly, "it's no use."
"Don't abandon the Comet," cried Eddie Willers. "Don't let it go. Oh, God, don't let it go."
"Are you crazy?" cried the barker. "You've no idea what's going on at your railroad stations and headquarters. They're running around like a pack of chickens with their heads cut off. I don't think there's going to be a railroad left in business this side of the Mississippi by tomorrow morning."
"Better come along, Mr. Willers," said the conductor.
"No,"
cried Eddie, clutching the metal rung as if he wanted his hand to grow fast to it. The barker shrugged.
"Well, it's your funeral."
"Which way are you going?" asked the engineer, not looking at Eddie.
"Just going, brother. Just looking for some place to stop, somewhere. We're from Imperial Valley, California. The People's Party crowd grabbed the crops and any food we had in the cellars. Hoarding, they called it. So we just picked up and went. Gotta travel by night on account of the Washington crowd. We're just looking for some place to live.
You're welcome to come along, buddy, if you've got no home. Or else we can drop you off closer to some town or another.
The men of that caravan, thought Eddie indifferently, looked too mean-minded to become the founders of a secret, free settlement, and not mean-minded enough to become a gang of raiders. They had no more destination to find than the motionless beam of the headlight, and, like that beam, they would dissolve somewhere in the empty stretches of the country. He stayed on the ladder, looking up at the beam. He did not watch while the last men ever to ride the Taggart Comet were transferred to the covered wagons. The conductor went last.
"Mr. Willers," he called desperately, "come along."
"No," said Eddie.
The sideshow Barker waved his arm in an upward sweep at Eddie's figure on the side of the engine above their heads.
"I hope you know what you're doing," he cried, his voice half threat, half plea. "Maybe somebody will come this way to pick you up. Next week or next month. Maybe. Who's going to these days?"
"Get away from here," said Eddie Willers. He climbed back into the cab when the wagons jerked forward and went swaying and creaking off into the night. He sat in the engineer's chair of a motionless engine, his forehead pressed to the useless throttle. He felt like the captain of an ocean liner in distress, who preferred to go down with his ship rather than be saved by the canoe of savages taunting him with the superiority of their craft. Then suddenly, he felt the blinding surge of a desperate, righteous anger. He leaped to his feet, seizing the throttle. He had to start this train. In the name of some victory that he could not name, he had to start the engine moving. Past the stage of thinking, calculation, or fear, moved by some righteous defiance, he was pulling levers at random. He was jerking the throttle back and forth. He was stepping on the dead man's pedal, which was dead. He was groping to distinguish the form of some vision that seemed both distant and close, knowing only that his desperate battle was fed by that vision and was fought for its sake. "Don't let it go," his mind was crying, while he was seeing the streets of New York. "Don't let it go," while he was seeing the lights of railroad signals. "Don't let it go," while he was seeing the smoke rising proudly from factory chimneys, while he was struggling to cut through the smoke and reach the vision at the root of these visions. He was pulling at coils of wire. He was linking them and tearing them apart, while the sudden sense of sun rays and pine trees kept pulling at the corners of his mind. "Dagny," he heard himself crying soundlessly. "Dagny, in the name of the best within us." He was jerking at futile levers and at a throttle that had nothing to move. "Dagny," he was crying to a 12-year-old girl in a sunlit clearing of the woods. "In the name of the best within us. I must now start this train. Dagny." That is what it was. And you knew it then, but I didn't. You knew it when you turned to look at the rails. I said, not business or earning a living. But Dagny, business and earning a living, and that in man which makes it possible? That is the best within us. That was the thing to defend. In the name of saving it, Dagny, I must now start this train. When he found that he had collapsed on the floor of the cab and knew that there was nothing he could do here any longer, he rose and he climbed down the ladder, thinking dimly of the engine's wheels, even though he knew that the engineer had checked them. He felt the crunch of the desert dust under his feet when he let himself drop to the ground. He stood still, and in the enormous silence, he heard the rustle of tumbleweeds stirring in the darkness, like the chuckle of an invisible army made free to move when the comet was not. He heard a sharper rustle close by, and he saw the small gray shape of a rabbit rise on its haunches to sniff at the steps of a car of the Taggart Comet.
With a jolt of murderous fury, he lunged in the direction of the rabbit as if he could defeat the advance of the enemy in the person of that tiny gray form. The rabbit darted off into the darkness, but he knew that the advance was not to be defeated. He stepped to the front of the engine and looked up at the letters TT. Then he collapsed across the rail and lay sobbing at the foot of the engine, with the beam of a motionless headlight above him going off into a limitless night. The music of Richard Halley's Fifth Concerto streamed from his keyboard, past the glass of the window, and spread through the air, over the lights of the valley. It was a symphony of triumph. The notes flowed up. They spoke of rising, and they were the rising itself. They were the essence and the form of upward motion. They seemed to embody every human act and thought that had ascent as its motive. It was a sunburst of sound, breaking out of hiding and spreading open. It had the freedom of release and the tension of purpose. It swept space clean and left nothing but the joy of an unobstructed effort. Only a faint echo within the sounds spoke of that from which the music had escaped, but spoke in laughing astonishment at the discovery that there was no ugliness or pain, and there never it had to be. It was the song of an immense deliverance. The lights of the valley fell in glowing patches on the snow still covering the ground. There were shelves of snow on the granite ledges and on the heavy limbs of the pines, but the naked branches of the birch trees had a faintly upward thrust, as if in confident promise of the coming leaves of spring. The rectangle of light on the side of a mountain was the window of Mulligan's study. Midas Mulligan sat at his desk, with a map and a column of figures before him. He was listing the assets of his bank and working on a plan of projected investments. He was noting down the locations he was choosing. New York, Cleveland, Chicago, New York, Philadelphia, New York, New York, New York. The rectangle of light at the bottom of the valley was the window of Daniskjold's home. Kay Ludlow sat before a mirror, thoughtfully studying the shades of film makeup spread open in a battered case. Ragnar Daniskjold lay stretched on a couch, reading a volume of the works of Aristotle. "For these truths hold good for everything that is, and not for some special genus apart from others. And all men use them, because they are true of being qua being. For a principle which every one must have who understands anything that is not a hypothesis. Evidently, then, such a principle is the most certain of all. Which principle this is, let us proceed to say. It is that the same attribute cannot at the same time belong and not belong to the same subject in the same respect." The rectangle of light in the acres of a farm was the window of the library of Judge Narragansett. He sat at a table, and the light of his lamp fell on the copy of an ancient document. He had marked and crossed out the contradictions in its statements that had once been the cause of its destruction. He was now adding a new clause to its pages. "Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of production and trade." The rectangle of light in the midst of a forest was the window of the cabin of Francisco D'Anconia. Francisco lay stretched on the floor by the dancing tongues of a fire, bent over sheets of paper, completing the drawing of his smelter. Hank Reardon and Ellis Wyatt sat by the fireplace. "John will design the new locomotives," Reardon was saying, "and Dagny will run the first railroad between New York and Philadelphia." She... And suddenly, on hearing the next sentence, Francisco threw his head up and burst out laughing, a laughter of greeting, triumph, and release. They could not hear the music of Halley's Fifth Concerto now flowing somewhere high above the roof, but Francisco's laughter matched its sounds. Contained in the sentence he had heard, Francisco was seeing the sunlight of spring on the open lawns of homes across the country. He was seeing the sparkle of motors. He was seeing the glow of the steel in the rising frames of new skyscrapers. He was seeing the eyes of youth looking at the future with no uncertainty or fear. sentence Reardon had uttered was, "She will probably try to take the shirt off my back with the freight rates she's going to charge, but I'll be able to meet them." The faint glitter of light weaving slowly through space on the highest accessible ledge of a mountain was the starlight on the strands of Galt's hair. He stood looking not at the valley below, but at the darkness of the world beyond its walls. Dagny's hand rested on his shoulder, and the wind blew her hair to blend with his. She knew why he had wanted to walk through the mountains tonight, and what he had stopped to consider. She knew what words were his to speak, and that she would be first to hear them. They could not see the world beyond the mountains. There was only a void of darkness and rock, but the darkness was hiding the ruins of a continent. The roofless homes, the rusting tractors, the lightless streets, the abandoned rail. But far in the distance, on the edge of the earth, a small flame was waving in the wind, the defiantly stubborn flame of Wyatt's torch, twisting, being torn and regaining its hold, not to be uprooted or extinguished. It seemed to be calling and waiting for the words John Galt was now to pronounce. "The road is cleared," said Galt. "We are going back to the world." He raised his hand, and over the desolate earth, he traced in space the sign of the dollar. The end. About the author. "My personal life," says Ayn Rand, "is a postscript to my novels. It consists of the sentence, 'And I mean it.' I have always lived by the philosophy I present in my books, and it has worked for me as it works for my characters. The concretes differ, the abstractions are the same. I decided to be a writer at the age of 9, and everything I have done was integrated to that purpose. I am an American by choice and conviction. I was born in Europe, but I came to America because this was the country based on my moral premises, and the only country where one could be fully free to write. I came here alone after graduating from a European college. I had a difficult struggle, earning my living at odd jobs, until I could make a financial success of my writing. No one helped me, nor did I think at any time that it was anyone's duty to help me. In college, I had taken history as my major subject, and philosophy as my special interest. The first, in order to have a factual knowledge of men's past, for my future writing. The second, in order to achieve an objective definition of my values. I found that the first could be learned, but the second had to be done by me. I have held the same philosophy I now hold, for as far back as I can remember. I have learned a great deal through the years and expanded my knowledge of details, of specific issues, of definitions, of applications, and I intend to continue expanding it, but I have never had to change any of my fundamentals. My philosophy, in essence, is the concept of man as a heroic being, with his own happiness as the moral purpose of his life, with productive achievement as his noblest activity, and reason as his only absolute. The only philosophical debt I can acknowledge is to Aristotle. I most emphatically disagree with a great many parts of his philosophy, but his definition of the laws of logic and of the means of human knowledge is so great an achievement that his errors are irrelevant by comparison. You will find my tribute to him in the titles of the three parts of Atlas Shrugged. My other acknowledgement is on the dedication page of this novel. I knew what values of character I wanted to find in a man. I met such a man, and we have been married for 28 years. His name is Frank O'Connor. To all the readers who discovered the Fountainhead and asked me many questions about the wider application of its ideas, I want to say that I am answering these questions in the present novel, and that the Fountainhead was only an overture to Atlas Shrugged. I trust that no one will tell me that men such as I write about don't exist. That this book has been written and published is my proof that they do. This concludes the reading of Atlas Shrugged by Ayn Rand. Copyright 1957 by Ayn Rand. Copyright renewed Eugene Winnick, Paul Gitlin, and Leonard Peikoff, 1985. Introduction copyright 1992 by Leonard Peikoff. This book was read by Scott Brick. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with Curtis Brown Limited and was produced in 2008 by Blackstone Audio, Inc., which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audio, Inc. Thank you.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.